The film centers around Jennifer Laude, who was a trans woman in the Philippines that unfortunately was killed by a U.S. Marine. And the story really takes place when it's discovered that local authorities cannot detain the Marine due to these visiting forces agreements between the two countries.
There's a lack of justice in many trans people's lives. If members of our community are killed every day, then there is no justice in the world.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lisha Chappelle. Botswana's High Court considers queer sex ban challenge, far-right Polish party launches pre-election homophobic ploy, and slain Filipina trans woman's story survives in Call Her Ganda. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 16, 2019. Botswana's High Court held a one-day hearing on March 14th in a case challenging the criminalization of consensual adult gay or lesbian sex. Courts in the Southern African country decided a few years ago that the law applies to women as well as men. Attorneys pushing for repeal argued that Botswana society has changed markedly since the anti-gay sex laws were established, a gift of the British colonizers, and that they're outdated and should be overturned. Lawyers for the government said that the law should reflect on the values of society and claimed that while attitudes may have changed in other parts of the world, there haven't been any significant changes in societal attitudes in Botswana toward gay people to warrant repeal. Same-gender love was, in fact, widely accepted among the native Tswana people before British colonizers brought their homophobia with them, including a penal code that punishes carnal knowledge of any person against the order of nature with up to 7 years in prison. Another statute, Indecent Practices Between Persons, carries a sentence of up to 2 years. Equality activists attended the hearing in large numbers, some holding placards that read, "Stigma Must Fall" and "My Bedroom, My Privacy." High Court Judge Abed Nikotafa told the packed courtroom in the nation's capital, Habaroni, that a decision would be issued on June 11th. Kenya's High Court is scheduled to announce its ruling on that country's British colonial-era laws outlawing same-gender sex in May. Angola reportedly became the first country in Africa earlier this year to overturn its anti-queer sex laws.
Germany's Justice Ministry issued a directive this week authorizing financial compensation to people who were being investigated or taken into custody but not convicted under the country's Nazi-era laws against consensual adult gay sex. Even though the notorious paragraph 175 was instituted under Hitler to snuff out what had been a boldly emerging gay rights movement, the governments of post-World War II Germany's each kept paragraph 175 on the books until East Germany removed it in 1968 and West Germany followed suit a year later. Unified German lawmakers ordered the records of thousands of convictions under that law to be expunged in 2017 and offered payments equivalent to about $3,500 for each conviction, plus half that amount for every year of prison time that a person started to serve. This week's directive authorizes payment to those investigated and or detained, though never convicted, of about $600 for each investigation that was opened, plus about $1,800 for each year a person was held in pretrial custody. An estimated 70,000 people were convicted of consensual same-gender sex under paragraph 175, but the Justice Ministry announcement this week said that many more who were prosecuted but ultimately not convicted also deserved compensation. But it added a disclaimer that the payments are not to be understood as damages, but as part of a symbolic recognition of impairments suffered.
Poland's ruling far-right Law and Justice Party has decided to play the homophobia card ahead of upcoming European Union elections in May and national elections later this year in the heavily Roman Catholic country. Their favorite boogie people in the 2015 elections were foreigners. At its annual convention, party leader Jarosław Kaczynski warned that voters who fail to support law and justice this year would allow nefarious forces to influence the upbringing of their children. "Our opponents attack our social policy," he said, "and even worse, attack families. We will defend the Polish family." He ridiculed Warsaw's mayor for humanely liberalizing policies affecting LGBTQ people earlier this year, calling Rafael Trzaskowski's 12-point declaration unbelievable. He talks nonsense about alleged plans to corrupt children, the mayor shot back in a Facebook post. Trzaskowski described his initiatives as being about tolerance, to protect our fellow citizens from hate speech, intimidation, and lynching. Another opposition party member, Monica Rosa, said the entrenched right-wing government is building a campaign of hatred toward LGBT people. Let them really protect children, she added, by fighting against pedophilia in the church.
Queer organizations around the world joined the global chorus of outrage and sadness over the massacre of some 50 Muslims during Quiet Friday prayers in two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. An Australian-born white nationalist who posted a voluminous, hate-filled manifesto and live-streamed the massacre called his targets invaders. U.S. President Donald Trump expressed America's condolences, but went on to veto the congressional resolution opposing his so-called national emergency by warning of criminal invaders at the country's southern border. The queer U.S. advocacy group Human Rights Campaign called hate violence against Muslims a global epidemic, and said that, "We mourn for the victims and their families." Leading UK advocacy group Stonewall said that, "It's more important than ever to stand together in solidarity." A number of U.S. politicians already competing for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination also expressed their sadness and outrage. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, the only openly queer person in the race, so far at least, called the massacre an attack on us all. May every New Zealander and every Muslim hurting today feel lifted up in love and solidarity. And yet again, the obvious bears repeating, white nationalism kills.
A memo published on March 12th by the U.S. Defense Department has put the wheels in motion to implement Donald Trump's ban on military service by qualified transgender people. The new order bans trans-identified enlistees if they've already transitioned, and new trans recruits must be willing to serve in their birth gender and promise not to transition. Currently serving trans troops who aren't willing to serve in their birth gender will be discharged within a month. The directive gives all branches of the armed forces until April 12th to have the policy in place. The U.S. Supreme Court lifted the injunctions issued by lower federal courts stopping the ban, though some lawyers claim that a D.C. court injunction remains in place pending a final appeal. According to The Advocate, the trans ban will require the discharge of an estimated 13,700 service members out of the estimated 15,000 trans troops now serving. That would be the largest single workplace layoff of transgender people in history, despite congressional testimony from virtually every U.S. service chief that they've seen no discipline, morale, or unit readiness problems as a result of transgender troops serving openly in the military. Several LGBTQ rights groups assailed the move to withdraw the welcome mat laid out by the Obama administration in 2016 to honorably serving openly transgender troops. Statements by OutServe SLDN and the American Military Partner Association called this horrific policy even more cruel than Don't Ask, Don't Tell, to which many have compared the Trump trans ban, because the Pentagon explicitly told these service members in 2016 that it was finally safe to come out, and now they're being targeted for discrimination. The policy requiring trans people to serve in their birth gender or get out betrays our service members, the statement adds, and is based on nothing more than blatant bigotry.
And finally, Ireland's proudly out Prime Minister Leo Varadkar brought his boyfriend with him, Dr. Matt Barrett, to what he called a lovely breakfast at the home of notoriously anti-queer Mike Pence during pre-St. Patrick's Day ceremonies this week at the official vice presidential residence in Washington. Varadkar also met with President Trump, Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and other political leaders during his visit. Pence's wife Karen, who would normally have co-hosted the vice presidential breakfast, was conveniently out of town, so Pence's sister filled in. The vice president's wife probably feels quite at home in the queer, hostile United Arab Emirates, where she is on an official visit leading the U.S. delegation to the Special Olympics World Games. Mother, as hubby Mike calls her, has been criticized for teaching at a private religious school in the D.C. area that rejects queer students, queer parents, or any LGBTQ supportive student or school employee. Most such events are open to the press, as was last year's Pence breakfast with then-Irish PM Enda Kenny. But even the leading newspaper in his home state, the Indianapolis Star, criticized the vice president for meeting with Indian Irishman Varadkar behind closed doors. We don't know what Pence and the prime minister discussed during their get-together, though Varadkar vowed ahead of time to raise LGBTQ rights issues with U.S. officials during his D.C. visit. He was not shy about expressing his personal gay pride in brief remarks after a vice presidential introduction before members of the press were forced to get their breakfast elsewhere.
I stand here, leader of my country, flawed and human, but judged by my political actions and not by my sexual orientation, my skin tone, gender, or religious beliefs. And I don't believe that my country is the only one in the world where this story is possible. It's found in every country where freedom and liberty are cherished. We are, after all God's children.
That's NewsWrap, Global Queer News with Attitude for the week ending March 16th, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian Shazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
Hello, this is the actor Michael Emerson, Ben on Lost. It's not easy being one of the others. So if time travel or moving the island isn't an option and you're feeling sort of lost, try listening to Greg and Lucia on This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
When a U.S. Marine killed a trans woman alleged sex worker in Manila, the case may have gone without much notice. But Jennifer Laudet's story is being kept alive thanks to her bereaved mother, a determined trans reporter, a courageous attorney, and an award-winning documentarian. The documentary opens in the Philippines and the UK this month, and it's slated to air on U.S. public television in July. This Way Out's Christopher Gall sat down with the director to discuss his film and its worldwide impact.
Director P.J. Raval has been named one of Out Magazine's Out 100, was the keynote speaker at South by Southwest in his home base of Austin, Texas, earlier this month. His latest film, Call Her Ganda, about the brutal murder of a trans woman in the Philippines by a U.S. Marine, premiered last year and has been screening at festivals and in theaters around the world. It's currently nominated for a GLAAD Media Award. P.J. Raval joins us now at our Los Angeles studio. PJ, thank you for being with us on This Way Out, and congratulations on the nomination.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Briefly, walk us through the story of Call Her Ganda.
The film centers around Jennifer Laude, who was a trans woman in the Philippines that unfortunately was killed by a U.S. Marine. And the story really takes place when it's discovered that local authorities cannot detain the Marine due to these visiting forces agreements between the two countries.
When did you first hear about Jennifer Laude's story? How did you find yourself making the film?
Yeah, so Jennifer was killed October 11th of 2014, and I happened to be in the Philippines shortly after. I was fortunate enough to be invited to go to Manila to screen some of my previous documentaries, and when I got there, I discovered the story of Jennifer, and I happened to meet attorney Virginia Suarez, which is how I got very interested in the story.
You cannot help this case. You cannot help the Laudes if you just know things about the killing, if you just know things about the murder, because it's not a simple case of murder.
The police station, then I will have to, you know, check it one by one against.
The relationship between the U.S. and the Philippines is really a relationship between a colonizer and a colony or a neo-colony.
One of the reasons I also wanted to make this film specifically is, for whatever reasons, I think as a culture, the Philippines has really been overlooked in the United States. As someone who grew up in, you know, Central California, there was a lot of confusion on Filipino. People thought I was either Latino or I was Chinese, you know? There was kind of nothing in between. So part of me wanting to make this film was also just to expose people to the Philippines and kind of the true history, or one of the, you know, some of the history that's been overlooked and perhaps even intentionally buried, you know?
Full disclosure, I worked on this film. I played a small part in its production. Late in post-production, I designed some motion graphics for the film.
I wouldn't say it was a small part. Okay. I'd say it's a pretty significant part.
Okay. Doing that gave me a little bit of insight into the film as it took shape. One thing that I noticed, it was my observation, was in the early cuts of the film, as I saw them, seemed to focus a lot on the narrative, on the story, and how the events unfolded. The later edits, after you spent a lot more time in the editing room, integrated more of the stories of the three women, Meredith, Jennifer's mother, and Virgie Suarez, the attorney. Tell us a little bit more about how that evolved in your process.
You know, early on, when I started making this film, I kind of knew there were certain aspects I wanted to follow about this story. So the first was definitely Nanai, Jennifer's mother. She was really one of the inspirations of making the film. When I met attorney Virginia Suarez, she actually showed a clip of Nanai that she had filmed on her cell phone, and I was really moved by it. And it was basically Nanai saying, you know, how could someone do this to my child? I'm not going to rest until, you know, I see some kind of accountability. And I was so moved by that, just because Nanai just has such an incredible presence. Like, she's incredibly, she just has a lot of heart, very passionate. And also very much in a very difficult position where she has to grieve very publicly, and recognize just kind of what she's kind of up against, that no one's really paying attention to this and no one really cares about, you know, the loss of her child. So I was really moved by Nanai, and I kind of knew she was going to be the heart of the film.
She was working at a beauty salon. At the salon, she would wash and clean to get free food. Every week, she would send me all her money. And she promised, Mom, when I come home, they will not make fun of me and call me a queer. I will have accomplished something. My life has value, she said.
And having first met Virgie, I already knew that I wanted to follow Virgie, because Virgie is, I mean, she embodies action to me. Like, she is someone who is constantly doing, thinking, trying to make some kind of change, not only as a lawyer, but also as an activist, also as a mother, also as a woman. So I was incredibly inspired by her, and I started thinking of her as kind of like the body. So, right, if Nanai is the heart, then Virgie is kind of the body and the flesh and kind of, you know, putting things into motion. And then the last person I met was Meredith. And Meredith, as the investigative reporter, but also someone who is trans herself, I kind of thought of her as kind of like the intellect in the head, because she was someone who was really questioning things and really thinking about things from really large, from a much larger perspective than most people had. Most people had just focused on the crime itself, but Meredith was able to contextualize it and really understand the significance of it. So I kind of thought of her as the head, right? The brain. And so I started thinking of the three of them as this body. And that kind of came about while I was editing. And I started understanding how the three of them in their own experiences inform each other. Because all of them are working towards the same thing, just in very different ways.
The club was a frequent hangout for sex workers known as Pocahontas, a riff on pokpok, a Tagalog term for slut, which also alludes to the former colonizers who often patronized them. The most dogged of these women, those who quickly latch on to the arms of the men pouring off the ships, are usually transgender, but the foreign soldiers rarely learn that.
That was journalist Meredith Talusan in the film Call Her Ganda.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, Noah in the Noah's Ark movie and TV series, and you've discovered This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities. and those who love them.
We're talking with director P.J. Raval about his film, Call Her Ganda. I'm Christopher Gall. As you mentioned just now, the film is both, I think, intensely personal and of its time and place, but it's also sweeping in the questions that it brings up. It's the story of the family's grief and their sense of loss. Jennifer's story, it paints a picture of the daily trans life in the Philippines. There's a story of homecoming a bit in there with Meredith. But it also tackles the themes of international diplomatic relations, the echoes of colonialism, sex work, and these larger themes. How did you, as a filmmaker, balance the personal and the political, or the small and the large issues as you were putting together the film?
Yeah, it's a lot, right? I think the way you balance it is you treat it all equally, because it is all equal. And in a sense, like, that truly is embracing it from all the perspectives that it really needs to be embraced by. I think early on, I felt pressured from other people to make a true crime drama, for instance. And I said, well, if you do make some kind of true crime, like, you know, you might be overlooking other things here that are really important. And for me, the film really isn't about the crime itself. For me, it's about the environment of how a crime like this comes to be, and also what is the accountability for it, and what is the prevention of stopping something like this. So if we are looking at something that's kind of about, something that's more about structural inequality, for instance, you have to look at the bigger picture, and you have to understand not only the bigger picture, but how that affects people in their daily lives. So you can't really look at one without looking at the other. And I do think we're living in a time now where people are finally understanding how things intersect, right? And even using the term intersectionality. So just the idea of, like, how race affects class, and how that affects, how that's complicated by gender and complicated by nationality, all these things. So it's not so simple to just look at one thing. You kind of have to look at all of them simultaneously, because they all affect each other. You know, one of the things that I've had said to me about the film is, and from members of the trans community, that they appreciate that in the film itself, you see different representations of trans women, right? Like, some can be a reporter, some can be an activist, and some can be in Olongapo and working in sex work. All the different kind of roles that these women take, but also that they have different ideas. They live different lives, and sometimes, their experiences are very different.
There's a theory in physics that observing a phenomenon changes that phenomenon.
Ooh, wow.
How do you think making this documentary has changed the trajectory of Jennifer Lowdy's story?
Wow. That's a great question, and that's a really great theory. I think, in general, no one would have known who Jennifer Lowdy is if it weren't for people like Meredith Toulouson reporting, and Virgie Suarez standing in front of the courthouse, making statements about why it's important for us to pay attention to this, and for Nanai to be going on national television talking about how much she loved her daughter. Like, these are things that, change who we think Jennifer Lowdy is. And I would like to think that this film also does that, that it captures their stories, and in the process of captures Jennifer's stories. And in an interesting way, like, with all the films that I've made, secretly, they're also documents of my own life because I was there, to make it. So for me, when I watch the film, I also just think about how much it's also changed me in terms of, I feel much more connected to the Philippines. I feel much more just kind of proud of my heritage, but also feeling, you know, really special, that I have a unique point of view, you know, in the world.
The film is opening this month in the Philippines.
It is, yes. It'll be opening in theaters in Manila.
It's screened there before.
It has, yeah. We screened it at the Cinemalaya Film Festival and then and a couple community screenings.
What has the response been to the film there?
You know, a lot of people came to the screening and watched it thinking this is a document of their experience, because a lot of the people who saw it were, you know, at a lot of these protests, at a lot of these marches, events, you know, followed the story on television, on social media. So I think for them it was great to see something put together as, wow, this is, you know, not only does this document our experience, but it shows the growth of this movement. I think on another hand, some people were really intrigued by knowing that I'm Filipino-American, and knowing that there are people, you know, with Filipino descent outside of the Philippines who are paying attention and wanting to contribute somehow, and feeling like there's more of a connection and solidarity there. That's been really great.
There's a lack of justice in many trans people's lives. If members of our community are killed every day, then there is no justice in the world.
One of the things that has been really moving is screening the film around the world. There have been a lot of mothers who have come up to me and saying, I can't imagine this happening to my child. You know, and it's not even a coming up to me and saying like, oh, I didn't know anything about, you know, the Philippines or something, you know, I didn't know anything about the trans community. It's very specifically about, oh, I cannot imagine the pain that this mother is going through, because just even the thought of losing my child is so horrific. And I think that really just exposes the human connection, you know, that everyone kind of has, regardless of, you know, all these, you know, regardless of all these things like race and gender and class. And, you know, at the core, we are all, you know, humans, and there is a human condition. And I think it kind of uncovers that.
Documentary director PJ Raval. His film Call Her Ganda is currently nominated for a GLAAD Media Award and will be airing on television in the U.S. later this year. PJ, thanks so much for being with us on This Way Out, and good luck at the awards.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you can find more information on the film and a schedule of upcoming screenings at callherganda.com. I'm Christopher Gall.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and Michael LeBeau, produced with Brian DeShazer, and from Christopher Gall. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannum, Richard Merck, and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email TWORadio on AOL.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KUR, Kutztown, Pennsylvania, WCBN, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Fresh FM, Nelson, Tasman, Eastern Golden Bay, and Blenheim, New Zealand, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all stay tuned.